The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to the second part of this slightly unusual edition of Politics Weekly. I'm Zoe Williams. This episode is a recording from the Women's Seminar, hosted by The Guardian in May 2017 and sponsored by Pearson, where I interview our guests, Lindsay Hilsum, Leila Hussein, Karen Matteson, Amanda Gardner, and our token man, Dexter Diaz. The seminar was a way to help remind women and the men that we work with how battles are won and how progress is made. I started by asking our guests to introduce themselves, starting with Karen Matteson.
So I'm Karen Matteson, and I have really focused for the last 12, 13 years on the specific area of women and work, even though, and I can explain a bit more why later, the organisation I've set up is quite deliberately not got a women's brand, so we call ourselves Timewise. And I really had always campaigned on women's issues, but I'd never felt a barrier myself until I faced the job market as somebody who had children and who wanted to work flexibly. I was already working flexibly, but my challenge was that I wanted to move. And everywhere I went, I was told that, no, you don't fit anymore. What you want is not possible. So if you want a part-time job, either be happy with the one you've got and stay where you are, or do something quite administrative, which you're overqualified, but be grateful, because that's kind of what part-time work is. Or don't be silly, get a full-time job, get your arms around it for the next couple of years. This was before the right to request flexible working. Get your arms around it for the next couple of years, become indispensable, and then they won't want to lose you and they'll give you what you want. So, or stop working for a few years and be a mum. And none of them really felt like an option that I had ever thought of. And I guess what happened to me was, and I think that's happened to so many women that I've spoken to since, is that I assumed that the problem was me, and I thought, wow, I don't fit anymore into this world of work. And then I became much more politicised. I hadn't even thought to link it to all the women's politics that I had been participating in myself as a campaigner. And then I started to look around and I looked at the numbers and I saw that there were 8 million people working part-time in the UK, more than 80% choose to work part-time, but actually 77% of them feel stuck and trapped because they feel that they can't progress because the price of being part-time or flexible is that career progression, and you can't be ambitious, you can't progress. And I also found that there are 1.5 million people out there, largely women in Britain, who are working at the very lowest pay part-time work, who actually have the skills to be in more senior roles and to progress their careers, but they feel that the job market is broken for them. And then I looked at the job market through a different eye, and I really saw that, and myself, and I've set this all up with a former colleague, Emma Stewart, and we saw it through a different eye, and we saw that the job market, the employment market was really designed for the 1950s man with a wife at home, because it all works. If you have no constraints or caring responsibilities, the traditional fixed way of working really works for you. But the minute you want to come outside of that, you're really challenged. And so we've been looking for the last 12 years at the job market. We've seen that despite the fact, and we've made amazing progress, as Margaret said, on the right to request flexible working, but the job market, the way you're hiring, where you're progressing, is still completely broken. So while there's over half of the country now, the working population, who want or need to work flexibly for a variety of reasons, and I don't think flexible working is a women's issue, yet most of the flexible workers are women. But although half the population wants to work in that way, when you look at the job market, less than 9% of vacancies are advertised as being open to any flexibility. And that's the reason I felt trapped. That's why those 77% of flexible workers feel trapped. So I'll stop now, but I'll just tell you. So what we've done about it, and I'm thinking about your point, Zoe, about wanting to feel uplifted and feel like you can do something. And my initial reaction was very much of a victim of the market. Mm. But what we've done at Timewise is grow a social business. We've set up the first online job site for people who want to work flexibly and part-time. We launched that in 2012. And to just show the scale of demand, we never advertised for candidates, but we've got 90,000 candidates who've registered with us since 2012. And they are 80% of them are women, and I'm proud that there's 20% of men, and that's a growing group. And we've hired those flexible and part-time candidates for over 3,000 businesses. And lots of the work that we do now is around educating businesses in how you design jobs differently. And I think we're starting to make headway, but it's early days. And the final thing we do that I feel kind of gets me up in the morning is that we campaign for a better, fairer job market for people who want or need to work flexibly. So we've launched a wide-ranging campaign to business, because business, you know, it's business has got to respond. Yeah, yeah. Where 36 businesses now have signed up, including Mediacom, who I think are here today, and one of our most recent sign-ups, for a better, fairer, flexible job market.
Brilliant, thank you, Amanda.
Oh yeah, yeah, you do deserve a clap. So I'm Amanda Gardner. I lead sustainability and social innovation at Pearson. We are the world's leading learning company. And my job is really about how do we integrate social, economic, and environmental considerations into the strategy and the operations of the business, into the kind of heart of the business. And then I have a special role in our social innovation, overseeing our social innovation group to make sure that we're making an impact for our particularly low-income and underserved communities. For those of you who don't know Pearson, we are headquartered in the UK. We have about 35,000 employees around the world in 70 countries. And we serve all ages and stages of the education system with products and services. Products like educational content, so that means materials like textbooks, digital resources, things like that, which we sell into schools and universities. It means tests and qualifications, which many of you may have taken in the course of your lives, GCSEs, et cetera. And it also means increasingly integrated services. So, for example, we partner with universities to extend the reach of their degree programs through online programs. So we know that education is one of the most powerful ways to encourage sustainable development. There's a saying which everyone will be familiar with, you know, educate a girl and change the world. We know that women who are educated take better care of their families. They make more money. They make healthier choices. They give good advice to their families about making healthier choices. We also know that women who haven't completed education, girls who are out of school, get married early, often are subject to all sorts of violence and abuse, die young, die in childbirth. And so we're really committed as Pearson to helping to solve some of those big challenges. And we know that educating women and girls is one way to do that. We have a sustainability plan that has three pillars. It's about being a trusted partner as a large company. It's about reaching more learners, and it's about helping to shape the future of education. And one way that we're trying to deliver that plan, are trying to deliver it over the course of the next 5 years by 2020. I guess it's now 3 years. We did a review of how do we actually empower girls and women across our value chain, not just through the programs that we support philanthropically, but how do we empower women employees? How do we empower women who we're hiring to perform particular services or to help us in the supply chain? How do we think about how we're developing products and services that impact women? Because we know that 58% of our employees are women. We know that most teachers, the majority of teachers are women, and those are the people that are helping to distribute our products into classrooms. And we know that, you know, a lot of the influence of the students that we're selling to comes from mothers. So we think that we have a pretty unusual reach and a unique role to play in empowering women. And so now we're taking the results of the review that we did, which I can come back to, and we're looking at how we apply that systematically in, throughout the organization. So that's a little bit about us.
Wonderful, thank you.
She just looked at him.
My name is Layla Hussain. Just to give you a quick brief of who I am and how I ended up in this position. My background, I'm actually a psychotherapist besides being this crazy campaigner with a big mouth. I do have another job where I actually do get to sit still and listen to women's really painful stories. And I've being involved in this campaign, the anti... I always like to correct people when they say, Leila's an FGM campaigner. I like to say, I'm actually an anti-FGM campaigner or FGM advocate. I'm like, I would like to clarify, I don't advocate for FGM. I would actually call myself, you know, a social activist because, you know, I have always said, you know, you can't campaign against FGM if you're not advocated to end all forms of oppression against women and girls. To me, it comes under the same umbrella. 15 years ago, really, my story started. I was pregnant with my daughter at the time. Anyone have teenagers here that they're raising? Oh, solidarity, my sister. So it really started with her. I grew up in the West most of my life. I grew up between Saudi Arabia and Italy, funnily enough, but that's another story, another day. So I grew up in two countries which were quite, looking back, were very patriarchal and very religious, very conservative, and then I end up in the UK. I think my parents like to pick conservative countries for some weird reason. And I think people made an assumption, a girl with my accent, both parents who were professionals, hasn't undergone the practice of FGM. So I really became that voice. I kept seeing in the media, there was always the girl somewhere in a village, mm-hmm. which was never my story. So I got involved in this. It really came back to a health professional who asked me the question, you know, Ms. Hussein, can I just check if you've undergone this practice? And my response was really, I mean, this was really the truth. My response was, oh my God, yeah, I've been through it. It's not a big deal. Because for me, it was the norm. Mm-hmm. And the story that wasn't being told was a girl who grew up in the West also thinks FGM is okay, because there's an assumption if you grew up in the West, you think that's wrong. That was never the case. So, but journalists were actually not interested in my stories at the beginning because they just could not put a London accent with an FGM survivor. It just didn't work. It took a couple of years before I could have the chance to speak out. When I did, for me, it was important to create a platform for other survivors to come forward. And actually what happened, I was the first, I would say, the British survivor that spoke out. And what that did, it created other women who were also British with London accents, mm-hmm. children who were born here, came forward and spoke out. So for me, it was really being that voice, but also I wanted this to be a British issue. That's really where my biggest challenge really came in. Even though I spoke out at the time, even though the UK government had the law around FGM, and Dexter will talk about that a little bit in a bit, but for me, it was never considered as a British issue, and I really wanted the UK government to recognise that. So I presented a Channel 4 documentary where I ran around London town giving out vagina cupcakes. That is one of my approaches. Because for me, it was really showing, actually, this is about women's sex and sexuality. It's to control their sex and sexuality. But the British government was not taking this very seriously. And I went after, at the time, who was our Home Secretary, who's now currently our Prime Minister, Theresa May. So it's on record that I'm not one of her favourite people. Because I stood outside her surgery. The plan at the time was to have a 6-foot vagina costume to chase in the middle of the street to say, you're not really taking me seriously. And actually, I really wanted to make the point. Those who know me know I like to really get to the point. I don't like to tiptoe around the subject. And I think that's what happened with FGM. I created a really beautiful space for survivors to really explore the trauma they've experienced as children. For me, that's really, really key to this work.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, I've been told off for not keeping people to time. Oh, right, because that's my only job.
Okay, fine.
So 2 minutes, yeah.
Okay. My name's Lindsay Hilsum. I'm the international editor of Channel 4 News. I'm basically a reporter. And that's what I've been pretty much all my life. I do all international reporting. I do a lot of conflict and some combat reporting. So people are frequently say to me, oh, you're so brave, which is not true at all. I'm not at all brave. But one friend did say to me a few years ago, she said, you're so brave. Going grey in public on television. And it is true that most women on television do not go grey, and I did. And the reason I did, there was a number of reasons, and it was partly just because I couldn't be bothered to go into dyeing my hair and so on, but also it was because when I was young, as a reporter doing this kind of story, I felt I wasn't taken seriously. And I felt that I earned these grey hairs. I got them from something. I was never employed for my looks. I was employed because I'm a reporter and I get out there and tell other people's stories. I now work at Channel 4 News, which has been very, very good to me. I was at the BBC at one point. I remember I applied for a job as a correspondent in Egypt once. And this was a long, long time ago. And the chap who was my boss at the time, I went to tell him as I was applying. And he said, oh, yes, I think that's going to go to X. He's got an Egyptian wife, you know. I said, oh, I don't have any wife at all. Is that a problem? I hope things have changed at the BBC. So anyway, I remember going into the interview. It was a bit like this. It was a panel. Five, all men. And then the inevitable question came up, which I actually think they wouldn't be allowed to ask now because I think it's illegal, which was, you know, how are you going to cope in the Middle East, you know, what with you being a woman and all that. And I had actually prepared my answer because I knew it was coming. Well, I said, you know, as a woman in the Middle East, you know, one thing she's very good, which is that... nobody takes notice of that. You don't have to talk to generals or presidents. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a man or a woman. And when it comes to talking to women, of course, it's much easier than it is for men because often it's very hard for foreign men to talk to women. So as a woman, I can get 100% of the story, not 50% of the story. So I think it's much easier for a woman than it is for a man. But I'm not saying that a man can't do it. It's just more difficult for them. But, of course, it would be wrong to discriminate against them. I didn't get the job. But I made the point.
Fantastic. Anyway,
so that's Thank where you. I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Next.
Well, as the observant among you will have noticed, I differ from everyone else on this platform in one key respect, and that is I'm a lawyer. And, OK, there are two respects. But so my name's Dexter Dearce. I'm a human rights lawyer. I was appointed Queen's Counsel in 2009. I'm a part-time judge, particularly specialising in and authorised to sit on cases of serious sexual violence, which I've been doing almost unremittingly for the last 3 months. Mm. I'm also a researcher at Cambridge and have done research at Harvard, and my particular areas of specialism are FGM, where I've done quite a lot of work with someone sitting over here, but also all modes of violence against women and girls, gender-based violence in particular. You want to be short? That's it. That's all I am. I don't do anything else.
Thank you. Wonderful. Right, sorry, we are behind time, so I'm going to have to ask these questions extremely, extremely snappily, but I don't want you to limit your answers. I'm really struck by both Elif and Margaret talking about... you know, people making the same, generations making the same mistakes their ancestors made and things, and the time not necessarily going forward. I mean, how does each of you see progress? Do you see it as one continuous arc or a very kind of jagged one? Amanda, would you like to start?
I think it's, for me, it's definitely, I think we're making progress, but it's definitely jagged progress. I think, you know, if you look at 2012, we had the Olympic Games, and I think that was the year that for the first time, women and men were equally represented in all the sports, not equally in terms of teams, but women were on all of the teams for the very first time. And that same year, several months later, was when Malala was shot in the back of a bus for wanting to get an education as a girl. I mean, it's two very different extremes. And I think we've made a lot of progress. A lot of that progress is because of, you know, powerful women's voices, powerful women's organizations, but there's still so far to go. I think that you know, if you look at the developing world, what's called the developing world, you know, 2/3 of countries have now achieved gender parity in terms of enrollment in school. That doesn't mean that everyone's learning when they get there, but it means that now there's at least women and girls in school, along with men and boys. And I think a lot of that was because of the Millennium Development Goals and now the Sustainable Development Goals. But if you look at parts of Africa and South Asia in particular, boys are still 1.5 times more likely to finish school, to complete school. So we're getting people there, but we're not getting them out. So there's a lot of battles to be fought and won still. Okay.
I mean, just to add on to that, I mean, I do see a lot of progress, especially in, I mean, with Trump era. I can't believe I'm bringing him up again, the orange man.
We're going to have a non-Trump era.
I know, it's very difficult. But what it did, it showed, to me, the word, I know we keep using the word resistance, but that's so key right now.
Yeah.
But an area that we don't maybe necessarily acknowledge or still talk about, it's when I went to the Women's March, for example. It was great, you know, you can sense the energy in that space. You know, I was so proud as a woman to be there amongst so many other women. Mm. But one of the areas I was very disappointed about was the lack of Black and Asian women who were not there, because when we got lost, the five Black women that were together, we could spot ourselves. When my friend Louise got lost, I didn't speak to her till the next day because, you know, she was amongst the white women, still white women. And I think this is really important for me. It's questioning why were Black women missing from these spaces? Because mm-hmm. we need to be very honest about it. I mean, I own the position of being the angry Black woman. For years, didn't want to be there, but actually I own it. I have every right to be the pissed off Black woman right now. Mm. And for me, what the Women's March really kind of demonstrated to me, okay, we need to be very honest about this. Okay, what's happening in the feminist movement and the lack of voices of, you know, I think what's happened with the feminist movement is always one particular token Black woman we constantly use. Yeah. You know, even let's look at this room. I can count the amount of Black women I can see in this room. So I think all of us need to go back and actually start questioning that. I said to Jude Kelly, who's the founder of the WOW Festival, just recently, and I said, can we actually have an event where we actually blatantly call it white women, come and listen to a Black feminist. Just come. Let's just call it that. A panel full of Black women, hear our voices, because it's a totally different struggle. Being a woman's one thing for me. Being a Black woman, it's another struggle. A woman with a Muslim name, oh my God, I'm very popular at the Heathrow security. I get stopped all the time just based on my name. So it's important that we do, yes, there's a progress that's happening, but we also need to acknowledge areas that we really not are targeting.
Yep. Lindsay, you've got a kind of comparative oversight on this, because you know, obviously you go to a lot of war zones and then you exist in the UK. Do you think there's a kind of, do you think the most progressive country imports its values to the others, or the least progressive country imports its values to its neighbours?
Well, it's not an easy time to be cheerful about what's going on. And I suppose the only thing that I can say is that, I think that what happens to women in war is much more understood and taken much more seriously now than it was than when I started as a journalist. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that has happened in my lifetime as a journalist is that the Rwanda tribunal in Arusha actually defined rape as a war crime. For the first time, and there was a particular case. And what was very interesting is that one of the first people to be convicted under that was Paulina Nyiramasuhuka, who was a woman. In fact, she was the minister for women. I knew her in Rwanda, and she got her son to go and rape women for ethnic reasons, basically. It was complicated stuff. It was a pretty horrible case. But it was interesting that that has come up as an issue much more. And the issue of rape as a crime of war, I think, is much more on... understood and much more publicised. What makes me despair is that it doesn't seem to have made it lessen. It seems to happen much more. But somebody was telling me the other day that, and this was in DRC, DR Congo, which is one of the places where it's worse, that somebody did talk to her afterwards and said, well, do you think that we will end up in prison if we do all these things? You said, well, you know, I think you might. And so there is that consciousness of international law. I don't know if you want to say something about that, which I think is...
Don't get me started.
No, but I just... it's a grain of hope that I... It's a grain... Because I think that as journalists, we love to think that, you know, we can make a difference, you know. Yeah. We can change the world. Well, time has lessened my faith in that. Mm. But maybe... by publicising things, and then there is another thing.
Can I say, is critical, because I've been doing work in Central Africa with the United Nations, and some of you will know about Central African Republic and the civil war there. Same sort of issues, the effective ethnic cleansing of the Muslim... How many people know about the effective ethnic cleansing of the Muslim population in Central African Republic? Yeah. Virtually no one in this country knows about that. It's one of the biggest human rights tragedies on the planet. But in terms of, and one of the things that's happened in CAR, I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'll talk about it. One of the things that happens in CAR, which is very interesting, is the use of child soldiers. And so we were over there and we were trying to get the various armed groups to demobilise children. Particularly, they use girls, and you look at the gender difference, they use girls as effective concubines. They call them bush brides for the commanders. And boys, young boys, are used as frontline troops because they're expendable. They're not as important as adults, so they used to use up the bullets of the enemy. So we were trying to get them to demobilise children. And the most effective way that there was to do that was to say to them, listen, using children underage in armed combat is a war crime. And the rule of law is critical because we will come after you. And the failure of the rule of law is something that leads to a lot of these atrocities. If there is the knowledge that there is going to be the reinstatement of the rule of law, then they think again. And some of the children were released. One of the interesting things about it, and one of the consequences, something I've been trying to look at in my research about the way in which gender violence is so insidious and so pervasive. Some of the young women, the girls who were released, went back to the armed groups. And so we'd got them out, and then they would go back. Because of various arguments, but in terms of neuroplasticity, where they've got young people who, at formative ages, who are exposed to that level of trauma, and so when perhaps we can talk about social norms in a minute,
yeah.
It becomes very difficult to shift it. We've been talking with really brilliant researchers, both in the States and in Germany, who are trying to devise stratagems in order to break that cycle so that when they get out, that's only the beginning of the problem. Mm. Once you get them out, that's only the beginning of the problem. Yeah. But can I just say, the first question was about progress, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just give you one concrete example and I'll shut up about
that? Yes, do that.
I was speaking to Margaret Hodge about it, and she was asking me, you know, as a QC and a judge, what's happened in terms of sexual violence. Interesting, in one of the court centres where I sit as a judge, a part-time judge, I was told by the list office that of the effective trials, that's the trials that are contested in that Crown Court, 50% of the upcoming trials were sexual violence trials.
What?
So that is a massive difference, and so much so that I was specifically asked to go and do sexual violence cases back to back for the last few months. There's such a backlog. And now that is a good thing in some ways, because there's no empirical evidence that the incidence of violence against women and children has increased. But post-Savile, there is a greater awareness amongst victims and complainants. Institutions are taking, like the police and the Crown Prosecution Service, are taking it more seriously. And so on that level, there is progress, but there is a note of caution. Sitting as I do, a little bit like on a platform like this, you're sort of slightly elevated and detached from proceedings unfolding in the well of the court in front of you. You see again and again how the system itself re-traumatises victims and complainants. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I'm doing, I'm now part of what we call a facilitator. The bar is rolling out a programme on vulnerability of witnesses, whether women or children or other people who are subject to serious violence. Because the way in which they are treated by the system, the way in which they are questioned when they're in court, is a form of re-traumatisation, in my judgment. And the appreciation of these difficult issues in the profession is not great. And so we're launching a systematic programme to try and address that. So I think that's a vital, vital thing that we need to do as well.
Right.
Because you have progress, you have more prosecution, and then you have more people re-traumatised. You still have low conviction rates.
Yeah.
And then the actual person who has experienced that, is she or he any better off as a result?
Yeah.
That's what we have to think about.
Great. Karen, how much do these battles overlap? You know, when you're working for systems change in the workplace and women on boards and gender pay gap stuff, and then you kind of hear a story, you hear about sexual violence or you hear about global development goals,
Do you feel like they're all part of the same symphony, or do you sometimes feel that we're trying to do too much with feminism?
I suppose I think it's really interesting, because I think for me, creating change required focusing on one issue,
yeah,
and really focusing on that. But I see a complete link, because what does proper equality of opportunity in the workplace mean? It means economic empowerment, freedom. It means you can live the way you want, you can progress how you want, you can adjust your caring responsibilities. I think it has got quite fragmented in the discussion. Mm-hmm. So if you just think about the discussions around work,
yeah,
you know, as if women on boards is a thing in itself.
Yeah, I know.
And it's like, we're not going to have a problem with women on boards if you don't have a problem losing those women in the first place. And they can progress, they can have flexibility in their career, they can feel welcome in the workplace. And I feel a bit that there's been a huge focus on fixing the women and fixing the system in which they operate. So huge amount of energy on women's networks. And my personal bugbear at the moment is that these take place often at 6:30 at night, straight from work. It's a nightmare for many women to even attend. But, you know, I guess women's networks, diversity initiatives, which say to women, you know, come in, you're welcome, we want you, we love you, we want women here. And then the minute they get through the door, it's right, this is how we do things, and it's how we've always done things.
Yeah.
So I see a complete link between, you know, gender pay gap's not about equal pay. It's about occupational segregation. It's about leaving the workforce and not getting back to where you should be. So I think it's really linked. But for me, progress felt like it had to happen about focusing on a single thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of what you were saying, Elif, it's about sisterhood and supporting the other things on the way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was just going to add to that. I mean, I think there's a really interesting parallel with the Sustainable Development Goals, actually. A lot of people said 17 Sustainable Development Goals, that's crazy. It's way too many. But there was another kind of camp that said, but we have to isolate these issues and highlight their importance to the development agenda. It's really interesting, because you really do need to tackle these challenges as they are. But at the same time, each of those SDGs are interdependent. You know, you cannot cut poverty if you're not educating, you know, providing children with a quality education, and so on and so forth. And I think what's interesting is exactly what you say. You know, as a representative of a company, you know, I see a lot of companies making changes to provide flexi time or a great maternity coverage. You cannot do that without looking at how are you going to reintegrate women into the workforce when they come back from women. How are you going to ensure they progress?
You can't.
Join the 30% club and have 30% or hopefully 50% of women's participation in boards if you're not paying women and men equally in the company. So these things are all interrelated, but I think ultimately it's all about raising the status of women. And I think one of the really interesting things that happened this year is this whole, is not usually where my energy lies, but was on Twitter with this whole hashtag nevertheless she persisted hashtag that went around, because that came out of the, you know, Elizabeth Warren, I think, was on the floor of Congress and was told she couldn't speak out. And that, you know, all of a sudden, a whole generation of women, of new feminists, were like, what? Nevertheless, she persisted. I thought that was incredible. Incredible.
Talking about politics, we are in a kind of strongman political era. How do you all feel about that as a threat to women's rights? Do you think it's going to blow itself out? Do you think we're at the beginning of something really dangerous? I mean, Lindsay.
I hope it's going to blow itself out. I mean, you know, and we see it everywhere from Erdogan to Trump to Duterte in the Philippines and so on. But it happens for a reason. I mean, it's not something that's come out of the blue. And this is where you can't divorce feminist issues from class issues and other issues. There is an issue about people who have felt neglected, and people who are frightened by the modern world, and people who feel they are left behind, and they are men and women as well, and women have voted for these strong men. And so I think you have to look at why people have done this, mm-hmm, and what other answers, what other solutions there are for those people. Because I think that, you know, we may all be lovely Guardianista, Channel 4 Nista, you know, delightful cappuccino drinking people. But the fact of the matter is that gay rights and feminism is very threatening to a lot of people. And maybe we have pushed too fast, pushed too hard, been too politically correct, said you can't stand against these. And if you are against these things, then you are lower than dirt.
So what? Hang on a sec. Who wants to argue against that?
No, I'm just going to say maybe we have to rethink sometimes how we talk about things.
Our agenda, we present our presentation?
This. Both.
Okay.
We have to allow ourselves to be challenged.
Okay.
Well, I agree we have to allow ourselves to be challenged, but I disagree that we are pushing... When we're arguing for a human right, a right to dignity, I am unapologetic about it. I do not think you can push too hard about that. The question is dealing with the consequence of it. Yes. But, for example, think about FGM, the work that we're doing in sub-Saharan Africa on that. The pushback on that is, well, you're challenging thousands of years of entrenched cultural tradition. And my answer to that is good. It's about time. That's what we should be doing and should have been doing in the past. But, OK, let's not cry about the past. But from this point, it is wrong. Cutting girls is wrong. It serves no sensible purpose. It suits people in power. It enforces social control of women. It controls their sexuality. All of those things are wrong. All of those things are wrong.
Of course I would totally agree with that. But I'm looking at the broader issue. Winston Churchill once said, however beautiful the strategy, sometimes you have to look at the results. Right, and what the results we're looking at the moment, and I'm not talking about FGM because I totally, I get what both of you are saying on that. What I'm talking about is why have these strong men come to power? Why have people opted for that? Is there anything that we have to re-examine in what we do, the way we think, the way we present ourselves? You have to be open to that because we do not have a monopoly on rightness. I certainly don't anyway.
No, but I don't think it's right to say necessarily that because we presented human rights arguments in a particular way, that's created a backlash. These are deep structural issues that are creating global insecurity, the deindustrialization of the West, all of these matters. It's a complex field. But for me, it's a cop-out for us to say, well, we shouldn't be as strident about defending people's rights. We should be more strident. This is the time where we have to be more strident about defending people's rights, in my judgment. Okay. This is where you need lawyers. This is where you need human rights. Not when we're living in a time of plenty. When you're in a time of struggle, that's where you need to enforce and fight for your rights. Because, Aristotle told us, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Aristotle told us, you only get the justice that you fight for. That's it. That justice actually is a verb. And if you want it, you've got to fight for it. And now's the time we have to fight,
That's very rousing. Thank you.
To add a point to what Dex has said, because that's really where I am. But also, if I put on a therapy hat right now, when we see the behaviour of, for example, what happened in the US where 52% white women voted a predator in, for me, it was actually going into that space where I thought, right, I know in human behaviour, when we behave in such a way, it comes from somewhere. Mm-hmm. So for me, I always go back to the reason I thought FGM was okay and a woman who voted for Trump thought was okay, it goes back to the system we grew up in, meaning our education system. Look at our education system. If I give an example in the UK, there was a research done by Everyday Sexism Project. Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Really, really great project. And one of the outcomes from that project was our education system, our biology books, for example, don't have, this is crazy, they don't have the clitoris organ on there. But can you, and I remember when I heard this and I thought, no, it can't be right. Then I looked back and I thought, wait a minute, I don't remember my science teacher standing there saying, this is the clitoris organ, it's for women to pleasure themselves. I don't remember that ever happening in my school. So I quickly went back home and looked at the book and it was not there. I know it sounds like a really weird example, but what I'm going back to, the example is the reason women voted or people felt the way they did because we have a foundation, a system that helps people think in this way. Or because, sometimes when we talk about, girls' education, girls have education. Yes, girls having vacations is one thing, but when we don't educate girls about their rights and their body and their right to their sexual freedom,
absolutely.
I don't care what A-levels or what university she's been to, because she's still stuck in that same system, because the women who voted for Trump were middle-class white women.
Yeah.
So for me, it's looking at, that's really where we need to target it from. So it needs to come from different positions, but we really need to go back. That's why I said, you know, I cannot tackle FGM if there are laws and policies that discriminate against us on a daily basis.
I'm going to stick up for Lindsay. I don't think, and forgive me if I put words in your mouth, I don't think you were saying we shouldn't fight for human rights.
It's all right. No, she didn't.
I think actually you were saying, I think what we heard from the keynote speaker this morning, which is sometimes you have to meet people where they are.
Exactly.
And, you know, yes, 52% of white women voted in a predator. But we're seeing the result of that. And, you know, actually the marches, I was going to say the name of the hats, but I'm not going to. All of that stuff just gets those people more involved, more anti, you know, feminism in some cases. And so how do you, you know, and we might disagree on that, but I'm just going to give you, you know, my work in sustainability for a multinational company. Before, I worked for Pearson. I worked for the UN twice. I worked for NGOs. I am very passionate about many issues. If I go into the boardroom, and I was in the boardroom with our Pearson board yesterday, and I was presenting on how we're developing products and services for low-income people, if I went in and talked about, this is what we have to do, we have to meet, you know, we have to address the human rights of these people, we have to, you know, do great things, I'd get laughed out of the boardroom.
Really?
Yes, you have to make the business case for why this makes good sense for Pearson. You have to talk about how it ties to our core capabilities. And why? Because it needs to be financially sustainable. And I don't all the time, I agree there are moments when you have to make the human rights argument. But I think if you get the outcome that you get a major multinational company that for a sustained period of time is willing to support low-income communities to raise them up out of poverty, I'm not convinced that you need to have the perfect rationale for why. You don't need to make the human rights argument. You make the business argument. And I think sometimes that has to be good enough.
I mean, I suppose I would say, in support of Lindsay, I think, I guess what I took from things like Brexit, I had a really interesting discussion with an Indian friend of mine after Brexit, and we were talking about the kind of emergence of everyday racism in terms of experiencing it. And she said, great, bring it on. I much prefer it to be out there because then we can have, we can have an education, you know, we can have a different conversation about it. I suppose what I took from what you were saying was somehow things have gone underground. And if I relate that to the workplace and legislation, yes, we've got flexible working, but all sorts of things are happening underground culturally. Uh-huh. And that's why I think we have to hear different voices, keep the conversation going. So to go back to your, are we going backwards or forwards? Yeah. I just don't think we can rest on our laurels. So for me, you do need to meet people where they are. I mean, I don't, you know, I think I am in both camps. I do agree. And I guess if I go back to why I called my organisation Time Wise and not, you know, we originally had a brand which was very feminine, you know, women focused.
Yeah.
But if I think about work and part-time work and the job that we're trying to do, it's been very, very feminized and it's not necessarily been a good thing for women. So actually the conversation I need to have is a business conversation, which is how do we create more flexible jobs? Those women will come to them and they need us to help the workplace rather than always just speak to them.
I'm thrilled about this. It's actually very difficult to start a fight on the International Women's Day.
Oh, dear.
Job,
yeah, well, it is. We came
to
the
conflict.
I like you've made a conflict zone in this very room.
That's it for this episode. Next week, you'll hear our audience from the night, whose stories are enormously inspiring and whose advice is priceless. If you want to contribute to the discussion or have an inspiring story you'd like to share of personal triumphs, let us know in the comments section on this podcast's Guardian page or on Twitter @GuardianAudio. This podcast was produced by Rowan Slaney. I'm Zoe Williams. Thank you so much for listening. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.